It's Friday, June the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, President Trump says he might consider normalizing relations with North Korea.
Normalizing relations is something that I would expect to do, I would hope to do when everything's complete. We would certainly hope to do that.
The president faces a chilly reception from allies as the G7 summit gets underway. ZTE gets new life from the Trump administration. Indian farmers protest low crop prices, and we'll meet the ladies of Ocean's 8. That's on today's International Edition. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump said Thursday he will consider normalizing relations with North Korea if his summit next week with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore goes well. Mr. Trump made the comment during a news conference after a two-hour meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Washington.
Normalizing relations is something that I would expect to do, I would hope to do when everything's complete. We would certainly hope to do that. I know that Prime Minister Abe and President Moon have told me very strongly that they are going to go, and they will help them economically tremendously. Japan has a tremendous stake, and so do they. We, on the other hand, are very far away. We're very, very far away.
The summit with North Korea and trade were the focal points of the discussions on Thursday. Abe sought reassurance from the United States that progress will be made on limiting North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. He also wanted President Trump to discuss with Kim the issue of Japanese nationals kidnapped by North Korea during the 1970s and 80s. For his part, Trump said he is open to signing an agreement on June 12th with North Korea to end the Korean War, but cautioned that it is just the first step.
Yeah, we could sign an agreement. As you know, that would be a first step. It's what happens after the agreement that really is the big point. But yes, we could absolutely sign an agreement. We're looking at it. We're talking about it with them. We're talking about it with a lot of other people. But that could happen. But that's really the beginning. Sounds a little bit strange, but that's probably the easy part. The hard part remains after that.
President Trump also cautioned that he was ready to walk away from the summit with no deal, that is, if things do not go the way he hopes.
So I am totally prepared to walk. It could happen. Maybe it won't be necessary. I hope it won't be necessary to walk, because I really believe that Kim Jong-un wants to do something that is going to be great for his people and also great for his family and great for himself.
President Trump said the maximum pressure strategy on North Korea is still in effect, and the U.S. has not removed any sanctions imposed on Pyongyang. But the administration decided not to use the term before going into what he called a friendly negotiation. Trump added the United States has a list of more than 300 sanctions to put on North Korea, but he does not want to use them unless it's necessary. The president said if the summit goes well, he will invite Kim Jong-un to the United States. President Trump praised Japan and South Korea's cooperation during the past few months, and he gave credit to Shinzo Abe and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Trump also thanked Chinese President Xi Jinping for his help in the process. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo hinted Thursday that Congress might be given a say in any deal President Trump reaches with North Korea's leader. Pompeo was responding to a reporter's question about whether a future president could undo an agreement the way Trump pulled the United States out of the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran.
We are hopeful that we will put ourselves in a position where we can do something the previous administration didn't do. Right, they signed a flimsy piece of paper, and we're hoping to submit a document that Congress would also have a say in, that would give currency and strength and elongation to the process so that when administrations do change, as they inevitably do, and this one will, 6.5 years from now, when that takes place, that Chairman Kim will have comfort that American policy will continue to down the same path that, on the course that we hope we're able to set in Singapore.
Pompeo did not say if that document sent to Congress would be a treaty or some other agreement. He said North Korea had confirmed its willingness to denuclearize and called that the only acceptable outcome for the United States, and one that would bring, in his words, a brighter path for the North Korean people.
We don't think about it in terms of who has the upper hand. We know this has been a long, intractable challenge. It's gone on for decades. The president has said repeatedly previous administrations weren't prepared to do what we've done already. It's not about who has the upper hand. It's about trying to find a way where the two sides can come to an understanding where we can get concrete steps, not just words, that resolve this challenge.
The secretary said that both sides were very serious and that President Trump was going to Singapore with, in his words, his eyes wide open. Here's some of the top stories we're following on our website. Trump says, I'll invite Kim to U.S. if summit goes well. Trump will be sticking to his guns during G7 showdown. U.S. and China reach a deal to end sanctions on telecom giant ZTE. U.S. immigration debate shines spotlight on divided GOP. And most U.S. voters say NFL players kneeling for anthem is not unpatriotic. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us. I'm David Byrd in Washington. President Trump heads to Quebec, Canada, Friday for a summit of the Group of Seven Industrialized Nations. The president is expected to get a chilly reception from allies such as Canada, Britain, Germany, the EU, and France. As VOA's Millar Sega tells us, the meeting comes against the backdrop of increased U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum against Mexico, Canada, and the European Union.
Amid the collegiality and the smiles, a widening chasm as finance ministers from the leading industrialized nations prepare for the G7 summit in Canada.
I think you should expect a very heated summit by G7 standards, no doubt about it.
Jacob Kierkegaard, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says the Trump administration's decision to impose tariffs on aluminum and steel imports against its closest allies will lead to further U.S. isolation and the very real threat of a trade war.
Combined with the clear signal, the stated intent of the administration to likely do the same thing in the auto and auto parts industry, this is a recipe for not a global trade war, but a trade war with the United States against everybody else.
On Wednesday, National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow defended the administration's actions and called the disagreement a family quarrel.
President Trump is very clear. With respect to his trade reform efforts, that we will do what is necessary to protect the United States, its businesses, and its workforce.
But some economists say an America First policy will lead to an America Alone outcome. Some are looking to Canada, the host of this year's summit, to fire the opening salvo.
I mean, this is going to cause job losses for Americans, job losses for Canadians. We're going to respond appropriately to send a signal that that's not going to stand from our perspective.
Canadian and European countries have threatened to retaliate in kind with their own tariffs on U.S. products. But the family quarrel could have far-reaching consequences for U.S. leadership around the globe, which analysts say would benefit China.
This plays very clearly into the hands of China, to the extent that you think that China is a new and rising global power. The U.S. isolating itself is exactly what a Chinese leadership would want.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin rejects the argument that the U.S. has abandoned its leadership in the global economy and says the results, low U.S. unemployment and rising consumer and business confidence, speak for themselves. But inside the majestic chateau where the summit will be held, critics say an icy reception awaits the American delegation. Millar Sega for VOA News.
The United States has reached a deal with China to lift crippling sanctions against the giant Chinese telecommunications firm ZTE that will remove a ban that kept the company from buying U.S. parts for its electronics. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross told the CNBC network that the accord will force ZTE, which employs nearly 75,000 workers, to pay a $1 billion fine for violating the U.S. ban on trade with North Korea and Iran. It will also have to put another $400 million in escrow and, within 30 days, replace its entire management and board.
This is the first time that I'm aware that a major foreign company has been brought into strict compliance with U.S. export control rules.
Ross said that going forward, the deal imposes the most strict compliance on ZTE. He said the penalties against the firm should serve as a very strong deterrent for other potential bad actors to force compliance with U.S. trade restrictions.
This is a publicly quoted company. It had a $30 billion market cap before we took our action. The shareholders and will take care of the new board and the new management.
Ross added that the new board of directors and the company's shareholders would make sure that ZTE complied with U.S. demands.
The part that we will take care of is the key part. It's not our job to make cell phones. It is our job to make sure that they don't violate sanctions. And that's why we'll be putting our own compliance regime in and our own compliance people.
The ZTE agreement was reached after weeks of talks between U.S. and Chinese officials. The United States had banned access to American suppliers after learning that ZTE violated a settlement agreement by shipping goods to Iran and North Korea, nations that are under U.S. sanctions. The Commerce Secretary said he did not think the settlement of the ZTE dispute would have any impact on the contentious ongoing trade and tariff talks between the U.S. and China. Washington and Beijing have threatened each other with massive new tariffs on up to $150 billion worth of exports from the two countries. The fallout from the U.S. demand that China buy more American goods to sharply cut last year's $375 billion Chinese trade surplus with the U.S. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani has announced his forces will halt offensive operations next Tuesday until June 20th to encourage the Taliban to seek a peaceful resolution to the war. In a nationally televised speech Thursday, Ghani explained he has taken the unilateral move in response to an Islamic decree or fatwa top Afghan clerics issued earlier this week, calling on all sides to stop hostilities to pave the ground for peace talks. He said the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan announces ceasefire from the 27th of Ramadan until the fifth day of Eid al-Fitr, following the historic ruling of the Afghan Ulema. Afghan National Defense and Security Forces will only stop offensive maneuvers against Afghan armed Taliban. President Ghani added that the ceasefire is an opportunity for the Taliban to introspect that their violent campaign is not winning them the hearts and minds of the Afghan people, but further alienating them from their cause. The U.S. military in Afghanistan confirmed in a statement that they will honor Ghani's ceasefire with the Taliban. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that he welcomes the move.
I welcome the announcement of a ceasefire made by President Ghani and the government of national unity. This is a positive step forward on the path to peace. NATO fully supports an Afghan-led and Afghan-owned peace and reconciliation process.
A Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, when contacted for a reaction to Ghani's temporary ceasefire announcement, told VOA it was too early for him to offer any comments. The insurgents have not formally responded to the peace overture, but have since indirectly reiterated the Taliban's stance that it will not engage in any talks with the Afghan government until all U.S.-led forces withdraw from their country. Thousands of farmers across Indian states have been throwing vegetables and milk on highways and roads in an unusual protest to highlight farm distress that they say has driven them into debt. The growing rural crisis is emerging as a major challenge for Prime Minister Narendra Modi as the country prepares for the next year's general elections. Anjana Pasricha visited the northern Haryana state to meet the farmers.
Infuriated at having to sell their produce at throwaway prices, farmers dumped vegetables on a highway in Hisar in Haryana state. Dalu Ram is among the thousands who have joined the dramatic 10-day protest being held across 8 Indian states. His hopes rose when he harvested a good crop from his 3.5-acre plot, but a slump in prices meant no profit.
The seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides are expensive. The price I got for my crop is much lower. That is why I'm so distressed.
Farmers say crop prices have failed to keep pace with the huge hike in input and labor costs over the last decade. Those with small plots of land are the worst hit. Mahinder Singh Punia, who led the protest in Hisar, echoes what many farm economists say. Lacking direct access to markets and consumers, small farmers sell through a complex layer of intermediaries and get little benefit of high retail prices in towns and cities.
It is the markets who make the money. We sell at about 8 cents per kilogram and it sells for 40 cents. It is the middlemen who rake in the profits.
It is not easy for farmers to see their hard labor strewn on the road, says Vikas Sisar, another farm leader. But he says they want authorities to understand that farming is no longer profitable.
The government should ensure that the farmer gets at least 50% more than he invests, and all their loans taken from banks should be waived.
That demand is resounding across the countryside among farmers both old and young. 30-year-old Mukesh Kumar's story is a common one. He turned to farming his small patch of land when he failed to find a job after graduating. The rich soil and ample water in Hisar made him confident of easily repaying the loan he took to sow his crop. But after 8 years, his debt has nearly doubled.
I have no option left but to sell my land. The bank calls me daily. How can I repay the loan of $2,400?
Prime Minister Narendra Modi has vowed steps to double farm incomes by 2022. But with their produce fetching few returns, farmers appear to be in no mood to wait. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Hisar, Haryana.
Coming up, we'll meet the women of Ocean's 8. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Rescuers suspended search and recovery efforts Thursday at villages devastated by the eruption of Guatemala's volcano of fire. That left people with missing loved ones distraught and prompted some to do the risky work themselves with rudimentary tools. CONRED, the National Disaster Agency, said climactic conditions and still hot volcanic material were making it dangerous for rescuers, and it was also taking into account the fact that more than 3 days had passed since Sunday's eruption. Police say the confirmed death toll stands at 100, but scores more could be buried in rubble and ash. A Chinese ban on many types of foreign garbage implemented this year has created a crisis for the worldwide recycling industry, which is now looking for new markets for its scrap, As Mike O'Sullivan reports from Los Angeles, the trash ban put the brakes on a multi-billion dollar industry, and that has had repercussions in China.
The trash is piling up in Azusa, California, as sorters work to make the output cleaner. In Anaheim, bales of mixed paper that used to be shipped to China now fill a parking lot. Before the China trash ban, a ton was worth $100, says Richard Copeland of Republic Services.
Today, it's relatively no value. It's less than $5 or negative in some markets.
American recyclers say it had been a good relationship. Products made in China were shipped to the United States. Trash was sent to China, benefiting from low shipping rates for returning containers to be recycled and used in new manufacturing. Nearly $6 billion in waste was sent to China last year. Adam Minter, author of the book Junkyard Planet, says today much of it has nowhere to go.
Recycling is about manufacturing. And if somebody doesn't want to use those raw materials, then putting stuff in your recycling bin is doing nothing more than playing with your garbage.
China now refuses to take trash in dozens of categories, including low-grade plastics, unsorted paper, and some metal waste. It is demanding cleaner garbage in others. Mark Harris-Mendy of Waste Management says American processors are working to reduce contamination by removing unwanted items.
Blankets, pillows, a lot of things that really shouldn't end up in the stream to begin with.
Despite stepped-up sorting operations, they face a challenge: where to send it. Some of it will go to India, Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, or Indonesia. But shipping costs are high and demand is limited, so much of it will go to landfills. China's decision is about the environment, nationalism, and political control, says Asia-based journalist Adam Minter.
When you see China sort of pushing against the recycling industry, it's really pushing against private industry and in favor of state-owned enterprises. And that is very much in line with the way that Chinese economic policy has been going for the last 5 years.
Millions of small-scale Chinese recyclers made China's recycling business possible, says Joshua Goldstein of the University of Southern California.
Picking through stuff and making their lives slightly better every day through the money that they made off of that. It had environmental repercussions, but it also raised 3 to 5 million households out of poverty.
Goldstein says China faces hurdles to create an operation as efficient. Also, it could lose a consistent source of recycled materials. Meanwhile, American recyclers are struggling to find a new business model and, says Richard Copeland, a home for their trash.
It's waiting for a buyer on the open market. When it sits outside in these conditions and we have rains that come through, you start to see it deteriorate.
And lose more value, a cycle the industry says is not sustainable. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
A star-studded all-female cast led by Oscar winners Cate Blanchett and Sandra Bullock beefs up the new heist film Ocean's 8 by filmmaker Gary Ross. VOA's Penelope Pulu tells us how the new female-driven plot stacks up against its all-male predecessors.
In 3.5 weeks, the Met will be hosting its annual ball. And we are going to rob it. Not the ball itself.
On the neck of Daphne Kluger.
Valued at over $100 million.
$150 million, actually.
Hunger Games director Gary Ross felt it was time for an Ocean's movie with a female cast.
I realized there'd never been an ensemble like this. There'd never been a bunch of women coming together to pull off a job like this, and I could point to, you know, scores of male movies that were like that. And so the mere fact that it didn't exist sort of told me that all the more reason to do it.
Even if this was possible, you'd need 20 people.
7 people.
Why do you need to do this?
Because it's what I'm good at.
7 women, 8 with Debbie in the lead, take on Debbie's plan.
How long did it take you to figure all this out?
5 years, 8 months, and 12 days.
That was the time Debbie Ocean, the sister of the now deceased Danny Ocean, the Ocean's 11 lead con artist, played by George Clooney, spent in jail for art forgery.
She's the mastermind. She comes from a family of thieves. Her job is to just assemble the best and let them do some stealing.
Gary Ross's job was to assemble a cast of eight dynamic women on top of their game in the film and music industry today. Next to Sandra Bullock is Cate Blanchett as her close friend Lou and partner in crime. Helena Bonham Carter plays the bankrupt clothes designer who gets in the game out of desperation. Rihanna is the computer hacker who sabotages security cameras at the Met. Comedienne Mindy Kaling plays the dexterous jeweler who can disassemble the legendary diamond necklace inside the Met in no time.
Can't we just go to this? Do we have to steal stuff?
Yes.
And though they have their eyes on the prize, a $150 million Cartier necklace, their heist is also a dare, seeing if they can get away with stealing an impossibly large piece of jewelry at a celebrity ball while the world is watching. Another major character is New York's famous Metropolitan Museum of Art, where the cast filmed for over 2 weeks. Ocean's 8 recreates the annual Met Ball with luxurious costumes, beautiful people, and lots of diamonds.
Lucky you.
No one is more fitting to be at the center of this glamour and glitz than Anne Hathaway, playing vain and self-centered Daphne Kluger.
She's so kind of wild and out there and big and into herself. And it was really fun to get to play someone who occupies a world that I know so well, but hopefully isn't anything like me.
Ocean's 8 is a visually rich summer flick where a group of women bonds over the thrill of the game, revenge, money, and female empowerment. Penelope Pulu, VOA News.
Came on!
And congratulations go to the Washington Capitals, who won their first ever Stanley Cup ice hockey title with a 4-3 win over the Las Vegas Golden Knights. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 8th, much of the world observes United Nations World Oceans Day. The idea is to remind people how important the world's oceans are to all life on Earth, to celebrate their beauty, and to bring attention to the impact human activity has on the oceans. This year, the theme is preventing plastic pollution and encouraging solutions for a healthy ocean. The world's oceans cover nearly three-fourths of the Earth's surface and contain 97% of our planet's water. They produce over half of our oxygen, help regulate our climate, absorb carbon dioxide, and support the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Nearly half of all species on Earth depend on the oceans for survival, and for many of the rest, including for people, the oceans improve the quality of life. The oceans are also indispensable to the world's economy because they are key to transportation and recreation. And inasmuch as over 95% of the underwater realm remains unexplored, it is nearly a certainty that their depths may hold the cure to many a disease, the resolution to many a problem. And yet, as much as 40% of the world's oceans are heavily affected by human activities that result in pollution, overfishing, and loss of coastal habitats. Of particular concern is plastic debris. Some of it comes from ships that ply our rivers, lakes, and seas, and eventually makes its way into the ocean. But about 8 million metric tons of plastic waste washes off land into the ocean each year. Once there, it begins to break down until it turns into small fragments known as microplastics. Plastics are a serious threat because they degrade very slowly, entangle sea creatures, damage habitats like coral reefs, and are ingested by marine animals. Researchers have documented impacts of plastic on over 650 different marine species, including sea turtles, seals, whales, dolphins, porpoises, seabirds, and fish. On World Oceans Day, we must remember that the health and safety of our oceans is our collective responsibility, one that we cannot afford to neglect. Only through good stewardship can we safeguard the health of our oceans and ensure that the oceans continue to meet the needs of future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.